Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics. Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Fred Shankleberg.
And this is Kirk Gray.
Yeah, and Kirk was, we were just chatting offline here, and he's talking about a job he used to have and walked into his site. Well, you tell it, Kirk.
Well, I used to sell helium mass spectrometers for Vico Instruments up in the New York area. And I remember going to a college, and I was going to sell this new portable helium mass spectrometer. It was all fancy, had a lot of cool features like remote controlled handheld readout that you could see where the helium was leaking or quickly get a signal from the machine. Anyway, it was only the size of a bread box. It was very small. Now, the same company had made a model about 20 years earlier that was a roll-around mass spectrometer called, I think it was called the MS-17. And they were like battleships. They just didn't break. They were so incredibly reliable that they were actually interfering with selling the new product because they were so massively reliable that that I'd go into a selling situation and the guy would say, no, I don't want that new one. I'd like the old model, like that MS-17 that lasted 20 years. He says he knew how to work on it. He knew how to use it. And he, you know, yep, didn't have any reason to switch to the new fancy technology. And so it ended up that the company Vico started having a buyback program where they would actually give you credit, you know, or buy back your old MS-17.
You clean it up and sell it to this college guy lab.
No, they pretty much removed it from ever being remarketed again.
Yeah. Well, it brings up this issue, though, is, I've told the story about my grandmother's washing machine. It was cast iron. It was bolted to the floor.
Right.
And it had a switch on and off. And it went through a single sequence of cycles, probably on great big old relays. And that's what it did. And it did it for 50 plus years. And it probably would still work today if you hooked it up. I don't know where it's at. But
So some old technologies are very reliable and people really don't see a benefit. And what really started our whole chain of this discussion was about smartphones, and there was an article in the New York Times, an opinion article about your smartphone should be built to last. And the fact is that most smartphones will last a long time. There's nothing inherently that's going to cause wear out except the battery, and for the most part, or damage, you know, customer induced dropping it. And they're getting even better. Of course, now they're water resistant, highly water resistant. In fact, you can probably start soon. We'll see that you can go diving with it without a case on it. I don't know if that'll happen soon, but the phones are getting physically much more robust. That's certainly been driven by the desire for people not to, you know, have to be so careful with it, and the fact that people aren't always careful with it. But, there's a lot of trade-offs in making something like a smartphone easily repairable versus making it extremely compact and dense like the smartphones are today, where you really can't replace parts very easily. And there's no reason, except for the battery, that you'd really need to.
Yeah. Well, the screen, because we do drop
the screen, them. Right. The screens are getting tougher, though.
Yeah, they're getting
much
better.
Tougher, as I said. So it's all getting more robust. And, you know, again, the manufacturers are going to have a problem in selling new.
It's not new the product. Problem. No, I don't think that's, I don't think it has to be a problem. I think it's I think there's an evolution in across different kinds of industries, and in consumers is the most salient one because it's the one I see happening, but I've seen it in industrial systems too, where, you know, we got this new widget, right? We got this new service or solution we're selling, whether it's a smartphone or a car or whatever. And, you know, the very first cars were prone to break down and had horrible tires and no suspension and no seatbelts and no windshield and all kinds of crap.
Right.
And so next year's innovation was a major step up. And the, you know, five years later, it was night and day difference in what was available in just basic functionality.
Right.
Major improvement. Same with smartphones. The first smartphones were pretty limited.
Right.
In the first couple of years, they made leaps and bounds. But when you go from, I have two camera lenses to three camera lenses, then I'm like, okay, so,
The incremental benefit of the incremental benefit.
Right. But that's a natural progression. Now, there was a podcast by that Seth Godin does, and it's called Akimbo. And I'll have to track down what episode it was in, but he was talking about this nature of, he was looking at a car, and he was talking about hood ornaments, you know, the fancy ornaments. So apparently somebody bought a really fancy Rolls Royce, but wanted to make it even more fancy. So he had a sculptor cast a likeness of his girlfriend and put it on the front of the car. And then other Rolls Royce people saw it and they're like, oh, I got to get one of those too. So then finally, after a few years, Rolls Royce just put them on the cars. And now you can get them where they'll actually retract into the hood and get locked in so people can't steal them.
Yeah.
In Mercedes used to do this and all that other stuff. They were putting all these symbols on the front with a logo or some symbol. And he says, well, what on the back? Have you ever noticed on the back of most passenger cars and even trucks, there's usually some collection of letters and numbers that are, and he was complaining that the fonts were horrible and why were they doing this? But, and, you know, there's like a 250S Mercedes. Okay.
Yeah.
Does that mean anything to you? I mean, do you know anything about what that means? Now, if you're a Mercedes owner, you know that means that the it's a 250 cubic centimeter engine or cubic something, the displacement of the engine. And but if you have an S means standard. So if you got the 250i, which was the year later, it means it's not fuel injected. Right. And
I know there was a key to those codes.
There's keys to that, but it's usually only interpretable by people that really know that car line or own a car. And he said the primary purpose of that is that if you've ran into this, you buy a new car and it's the first red car you ever bought. And all of a sudden you notice there's a lot of red cars out there. You know, the week prior, you saw some, you didn't really pay attention to, but as soon as you bought one, now you saw a lot of them. And so you buy the latest model. So because in the 50s and 60s, you'd buy a car and the technology improvements were, I have rounded bumpers or I have a bigger tail fin or I have a different display of lights. There weren't really much of any technical functional.
No, there wasn't a lot of safety focus at that time either.
It was... You know, you might, they were slightly different variations for smaller families or bigger families or traveling salesmen or whatever. But there wasn't much reason to buy a new car other than maintainability and its maintenance. But the idea was that if I bought the 57 Chevy, I had the newest, latest, greatest Chevy, and it was obvious I had the 57, not the 56. That 56 is so last year.
They did a lot of cosmetic changes and body changes to make sure that everybody knew you had the most recent version. And it wasn't technology, it was the appearance of the car. So every year they had to spend a lot of money retooling the shape of the car, whatever. And not really so much adding the features.
It didn't get better gas mileage. It wasn't, you know, didn't do all this or the other thing. You know, and then they incrementally added feature sets. But the idea was to play on the human desire that when you buy something, especially a major ticket item, that it was a status symbol. You bought the latest, greatest.
That aspect to the smartphone market, too. That, you know, hey, I have an iPhone 12. You only have an iPhone 11. Well, the difference
you sold last year.
Yeah, exactly. The technological benefits of the differences between the two phones is fairly marginal. I mean, you might not even be able to tell much difference in the optical quality of the picture.
I've got 987 gigabytes of memory. You only have 920.
Right. And they are, you know, but some of the features, like the security feature of like going from the fingerprint scanner to a face recognition security system, is supposed to be better protection. So that was one thing that I saw, that when my daughter bought the iPhone 11, I liked that feature and felt that was beneficial.
Mm-hmm.
Although it is a problem with your mask now.
Oh, no, they just upgraded the iOS so you can do that.
Right. Yeah, so there's things that change that make it not as functional. But
you have to put a barcode on your mask, though. Is that true? I heard a rumor that it only works if you put a barcode on your mask.
That's ridiculous. So, you know, I actually, after I broke my iPhone 6S and said, or the screen, and I thought, you know, I was just looking for an excuse to get a new, really to upgrade to the newer, better cameras and options. And so I did take that 6S into one of these third party screen replacements. And for $100, I got a new screen, and it looks and operates just like it did when it was new.
Yeah.
And it said, well, I'll put that aside. And one of the things I think that this, you know, article should point to is maybe repurposing the older phones if they're still working, which most of them are.
Oh, yeah.
I would say the vast majority of people have more than one phone at our house that's still working, that may be a much older model.
Yeah, you could certainly take a phone and take it off the data plan, and it could still be a timer, an alarm clock. It could be a messaging device for keeping notes. It's got a camera. It's got all kinds of stuff.
All things. It's very useful. A music player, you know, just it's got so many features other than being what we can tell consider a phone, which, by the way, teenagers don't use. They don't actually talk to each other the phone.
No, they can type faster. But the idea, though, is that some industries, and the phone industry is, I think, plateauing, where, I mean, you upgraded, what, 5 generations, 5 years difference. Right. And I think as more and more people do that, they skip a year, they skip 2 years, skip 3 years. Well,
exactly. Yeah.
The smartphone folks are like other systems, like other types of systems that are counting on the annual turnover, is they're going to have to find a different business model. And the smartphones, they actually make more money on the App Store than they do selling phones. So it's part of it is that, right? The other side of this is like cars, they've moved into a model where they're adding safety features now is their selling point, or autonomous vehicle development type stuff is coming into it, or it's status. It depends on the brand, right? Sometimes it's strictly status. I have the newest Jaguar, you know, kind of thing. And that drives that kind of market. Other markets, it's, if I'm buying that mass spectrometer or that helium leak detector or whatever, I really just want it to work. And until you come through with this breakthrough that, oh, now I can do mass spec and helium detecting and CAT scans with my one device. Okay, I'll buy that. Right. But it's every industry faces that. And it's a business decision of how they create that model. And early on, consumer products are evolving. They, you know, the earliest TV sets were, they changed every year, and they were adding, you know, new features and capabilities and more range and more clarity and all this stuff. But at some point that flattened out and you'd have the old CRT and you'd have it for 10, 15 years. It wasn't worth getting the 2-inch bigger one.
Once we got away from tube technology, except for the CRT, solid state electronics made the televisions much more reliable than when my father was, you know, constantly replacing the tubes. But nowadays, I don't expect, like, I've got two smart TVs, LED, high definition television, solid state, not a lot of moving parts, no fans, nothing else.
Don't go walking in the yard over the sidewalk.
I mean, I think we talked about, and you know, I had an old Sony, what was called the TI. It was a little mirror chip. It was called digital light. I forget what it was called. It's not. It exists, I think, in theaters. It's still used in projection in projection theaters at movie theaters. Mm-hmm. But it lost out in the home market. And I see it, and I did see wear out in that that little chip, the mirrors, where pixels were disappearing.
Well, that's the point, though, Kirk, is when we got to flat screens, there was, what, five or six different technologies competing
right. Plasma,
to do this.
Yeah. LED, right, the mirror, digital.
Mirror. There was backlit, front
light
lit, this, all this stuff. And
yeah.
But there was a rapid period of evolution of these systems. And so it was kind of, yeah, that's a nice feature, but is it going to be compatible with the future of TV? Which direction are they going? Will it play my VHS systems or not? And
right. And there were things that didn't work, like 3D television. I bought one of those. And then it pretty much, you realized it had its limitations.
And there wasn't any content being produced for it, so that it never found its footing in marketing. So there's all kinds of reasons, but I think as that churn goes, and now the television sets are getting to, well, does it fit them? Like we bought a new TV a couple of years ago, and I finally got around to like, what are we going to do with this thing? I'm going to put it on Nextdoor, you know, eBay, whatever, and sell it. And this couple came over and paid for it, and they said this was their eighth TV. They now had one in every room. Congratulations.
Well, I've got too many computers now. I've got laptops that are technologically obsolete but still work.
Mm-hmm.
I've got some older computers that still turn on and boot up, but it takes forever to run anything, and they can't really run much of modern programs. So, you know, but their life entitlement is relatively infinite, you know, to the technological obsolescence.
Yeah. But I'm thinking is that, you know, like the new TV that you got or the new phone you just got, instead of, you know, the phone, you had a 5 years turnover. I'm doing about a 3 year turnover now. And I suspect for phones and I suspect I'll go to 5 years before I turn over this one, unless something.
So you don't replace your batteries, because that's expensive.
I haven't.
Okay.
No, it's been 3 years. Okay, so you
about 3 years is about your battery life.
No, it's still working. It's still working. It's part of my business, and I like the security parts of it, especially when I was traveling a lot.
But does it have the same life capacity in the battery?
The batteries are a bit bigger. I can go longer between charges with the newer versions. And that's been a steady increase over the years. But not my primary driver. I have plenty of ways to plug it in. Even on airplanes, you can charge. So it's back in. I haven't been on an airplane in a couple of years.
But that did change with from going from the flip phone. My first flip phone would last a couple of days before I needed to charge it. Now, most smartphones that I know of or have had, a day is about, you know, maybe 20, you know, a little longer than a day, day and a half, but you have to charge it at some point within that. It's one technology that has not improved as rapidly as the rest of solid state devices and technology.
It's a chemistry problem. It's sort of like mechanical.
Right. It's kind of limited. Although we're always waiting for the next, you know, fuel cell or something, some other battery technology that will be better. But lithium ion's doing a pretty good job and certainly established itself now with vehicles and phones and every portable device. And you said you even have a
TV remote.
Yeah.
It's a USB. It's got a built-in battery, and it's not replaceable, you know, like the old style, put in another disc. I don't have to go to the hardware store to figure out what kind of battery to put in it.
Right.
It's a little lithium, and I USB charge it every couple months.
And I don't have one of those, but we have plenty of remote controls. And one of the problems I have with the remote control is that little plastic cover comes off the back It's not very good. And so I've got the batteries hanging out.
Duct tape, dude. Duct tape.
Yeah, there you go. Right. I've thought about doing that. I have done that in the past. But that's a reliability problem. If I drop it, then the batteries go
scatter all over the place. I'm starting to pick up a pattern here of dropping stuff.
What's that?
You don't have to worry about planned obsolescence. You just drop it.
Yeah, exactly. So that was a technological improvement from that device that you don't have to worry about losing the batteries. You don't have to pay for, the cost of batteries.
It was also a big driver for me for my last laptop purchase was not that the laptop was obsolete or couldn't run software I wanted to run. I think that's kind of topping out in desktops and laptops, but they went to solid state memory. So
right
on a laptop, if you drop it just the wrong way on a desk and it's the disk isn't parked or protected well enough, you could lose your hard drive. And that just was not a feature I liked. So as soon as they had solid state drives, I went and got one.
But to be fair to the spinning disk people, they made fairly reliable, in fact, incredibly reliable for what we were asking it to do.
Yeah, but not if you drop it.
If you drop it. I've had lots of laptops, and the desktops in the early days were where I had failures of the hard drive.
Yeah.
But in recent times.
They're much, much better than they used to be.
But we know
that
solid state drives are more reliable and certainly have a lot of advantages in speed that a spinning disk doesn't have. So there are a lot of technical advantages.
I mean, the basic idea, and back to the article, and we'll summarize it a little bit here, is that, he was saying if we made it reliable and we made it repairable, we could keep it out of the landfill. And I think there's a balance there, though, of at first, in a relatively new field of technology, say the first flat screens, for example, or the smartphones, there's a lot of work to figure out, well, what works and what doesn't work. What features do they want or don't want? What is, how does that evolve in a feature set? And that evolves a lot of work. And so a lot of companies, especially consumer products, go to an annual cycle of updates. And sometimes like inkjet printers, they're updated every 3 months for a while there. But they dramatically improved over that period of time.
Right, the resolution, the printing,
speed, pixels, color, all kinds of stuff improved. Things. But then they get to a point where you can't tell the difference between the model 8752.6 and the next one. And the printer will last and last and last, so I'm not upgrading those anymore. But I think that's a normal pattern, and it's companies need to pay attention to their business model when they're doing evolutionary work, and continuing to do it, where it's in and of itself is prompting people to buy a new machine because it has so many better, cooler features or whatever. Mm-hmm. Or is it a status symbol type thing? But either one of those was counter to the Damon's article, where it was basically, let's just make the features set and and it'll last longer. We don't have to fill up the landfills,
Don't improve. Don't
improve it. I think that's the dilemma. If we want, want better and better systems that work faster, better, cheaper, we got to support that industry by buying new systems every year, every couple of years until they get to what like you and I are going and saying, all right, my phone's good enough now. I'm going to keep it for quite a while until I get seriously motivated by some other phenomena to make a difference. Where early on, it was every year because there were so many new features that you did that were available.
He talked about in this article about planned obsolescence. And I don't know that, certainly any company developing products has, in their long-term plan, the evolution of the product, improvements that they expect to be able to do as technologies become available that they're seeing in the future.
Right.
Okay. So, yes, they know they're going to improve. I mean, that's just a natural thing for the competition to be able to add to their phone to make it a one-up better than the other guys. And so there's always going to be a drive to make it a more you know, technologically advanced model with either better cameras, you know, better security features, all those things. And so you're not going to stop that. He can't do that. And also he's not considering, and he's maybe not aware, that making a if you're making a system for repairability or being repaired, you may have to make cost trade-offs
mm-hmm.
that make the phone more expensive because it's repairable, because it may be modular or something to that effect.
Right.
And so that's a problem too. People still want the lowest cost, you know, phones. So also, I don't know that companies other than the battery have anything that they know is going to fail in time. And that's
one thing. Well, that's where I think his argument of planned obsolescence is that Apple does this. I think your phone was at the point where they weren't updating it anymore. You weren't getting security updates. You weren't getting operating system updates. More and more applications
wouldn't
work
feature.
On it anymore.
Yeah, feature benefit. Right. That was features and benefits or technological improvements mm-hmm. that I wasn't able to get because the phone, either the processor was not powerful enough to be able to handle these new features or, mm-hmm. or programs, apps, whatever. And so from that standpoint, you know, you can't expect Apple to say, oh, we're not going to add this feature because
it's not backward compatible.
It's counterproductive.
Yeah. No, and there's a drive. There's a business model there that makes sense. It's Apple's right. not going to come out. Maybe they will. Maybe next year will be the big announcement. The last phone you'll ever need to buy. You know, and it's just going to be
the Apple final.
Yeah. And, you know, and that's a signal that that's the end of that market. And let's move to a new technology and evolve that one and create something different. But the articles sparked a couple different things for me. One was keep stuff out of landfills, but the other was this the business model drive to support innovation. Then tends to flatten out, and then you need to shift the business model, and that's a natural cycle for many, many different right. kinds of industries.
Right. It's you can't stop the evolution and the feature, and nobody wants them to. I want them to keep making better features.
Well, thanks for bringing up the article, Kirk. It does sure. highlight a couple of cool features and impacts with reliability, but it also highlights the need to balance reliability with where you are in the evolution of a product, the technology evolution of it. But it's also something there's plenty of people that over time want their system to last longer. And I think companies that recognize that are going to keep their customers, and that's all a good thing. So
right. But they're not going to sell a new product to them.
No, but they could do other things. They have now this installed platform. They can do other things with that.
No, that's true. They can add other features, you know, systems that interface with that,
right.
maybe. But
or go create a whole new industry. You know, they've done it before.
They have done it before. And a lot of them don't innovate. If you don't innovate, if you don't change and adapt and use the newest technologies, you're likely not to survive.
That's right. So anyway, hey, I want to mention again that we've got a new feature on a way for you to actually join the conversation. We're recording these where we don't have any examples of this right now because we're just starting to announce this. But on the comment field or page for the show, we now have a button that allows you to do a voice recording. And so you have 90 seconds. You can ask us a question or provide a comment or a short story, and it may well get incorporated into a future episode. We'll actually hear your voice and include it in the show. So you can head over to AscendoReliability.com/go/SOR. And on the upper right-hand side of that page is a little widget that allows you, you click a button and it lets you record it. I believe it also has the ability for you to listen to it and delete it or edit it or just re-record it. So you can get it what you want is right for us. It works pretty cool. I heard it on another podcast and thought, that's a cool feature. Let's give that a try. And it happened to be free. So we're going to just experiment with it.
I'd love to hear people's voices in some of our listeners. Sometimes in the tone of their voice, we can hear what their frustration is.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that would be cool. So I'm looking forward to that. So head over to AscendoReliability.com/go/SOR, and you can literally join the conversation. So that would be really cool. All right. So with that, Kirk, let's go back and see what else is in the paper or what else comes into our comments and questions. And
right.
And we'll get back together again and chat soon.
Okay, good talking with you, Fred.
Yeah, take care, Kirk.
Okay, you too, Fred.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation if you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show. Please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.